You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. If you're out of work because of COVID-19 and worried about paying rent in the city of LA, starting today, you can apply for rental assistance through a new program.
Thank you for calling the City of Los Angeles Emergency Rental Assistance Subsidy Program Hotline.
Now, to qualify, you have to earn below a certain income. And registering doesn't mean you're guaranteed help. You'll be picked through a lottery if you're lucky. Even with those caveats, it's the largest COVID-19-related rental assistance program of any city in the country. And still, housing experts are warning it's not enough to prevent what could be a massive wave of evictions due to the pandemic. KCRW reporter Anna Scott is here to talk about it. Hey, Anna.
Hey, Steve.
So talk about this program that's opening up today. How does it work?
Yeah, so like you said, you have to be a renter who lives in the city of LA. It's specifically for low-income households. So that means for a household with four people, you have to be earning less than $83,000 a year. And then half the slots will go for very low-income households. So households making even less than half of that. And it's for people who have lost income directly as a result of COVID-19. The way it works, the city will pay your landlord directly up to $1,000 a month to help cover your rent. But they're only going to pay a maximum of 2 months for any single household.
So that's $2,000. That's not even 1 month's rent for a lot of folks in LA. I mean, given how expensive it is to live here. And obviously not a long-term solution for all the folks who are unemployed and worried about housing right now.
Yeah, that's right. It's not a long-term solution. And I've been speaking with a lot of people who see this period that we're in right now as kind of a calm before the storm. You know, there are these expanded federal unemployment benefits that expire at the end of this month. Right now, evictions are on hold all over the state because courts just aren't processing them. And here in the city, evictions are banned for the moment for people who can't pay rent because of COVID-19. But those renters still owe that rent. They're not off the hook. So a lot of people are seeing this looming wave of evictions. One of them is Larry Gross. He's the head of the Coalition for Economic Survival, which is a renters' rights organization.
With people not being able to pay their rent because many of them have lost their job, they're incurring increased debt. And we're literally on the tracks of an economic train wreck if these eviction protections come off.
Larry Gross isn't the only person saying this. There was some research that recently came out of UCLA that predicted that 36,000 evicted households in LA County could end up homeless as a result of the pandemic. And there's another concern that I'm hearing as well, which is that in some cases where tenants aren't able to pay the rent, even if they're not being formally evicted, they're getting pressured in some cases from landlords to leave and sort of informally evicted. This is something that I heard from an attorney who does eviction defense work for the Legal Aid Foundation of LA. His name is Joshua Christian.
We have a huge and rising number of tenants that are coming in with what we would call pre-litigation issues, which are landlord harassment, illegal lockout, that sort of thing.
And I spoke to a tenant who says he is in that situation. He's afraid of retaliation for just doing this interview, so I agreed to identify him the same way he's identified in court documents that are related to the situation with his landlord, as David D. But he lives in the city of LA and works as a jewelry maker. He's lost income because of the pandemic. He's lost jobs. He shares a one-bedroom apartment with his mom that he pays less than $1,000 a month for. He missed his May rent, and he says the harassment has gotten worse since he missed that payment.
At first, they were hitting the walls around my apartment, kicking in my door in the middle of the night and in the wee hours of the morning. My personal mail disappeared because they were taking it. They also threw cockroaches through my door with the intention that they would crawl into my apartment.
Those are quite the accusations, Anna. Sounds like a terrible situation. The accusation of a bad landlord. Of course, not every landlord's trying to push out tenants at this moment. In fact, a lot of them are worried right now about how they're going to pay their bills, how they'll pay their mortgages if tenants can't pay the rent. So let's bring in KCRW's Jerome Campbell, who's been talking to landlords who are very worried about this economic situation we're in. Hey, Jerome.
Hey, Steve.
Tell us about that. Tell us about how landlords are dealing with all of this right now.
Well, landlords feel like they're the enemies right now, even though they're suffering too. They know everybody's suffering through some sort of financial hardship from the pandemic. But they still have to pay their bills, which are higher now that people are inside and they're using more water, using more electricity. So I talked with a landlord named Mike Warner, who owns 7 properties, about 100 units in total. And most of his properties are in LA and West Hollywood, and the majority of them are rent controlled. He says his tenants are mostly professionals and middle class, but he's got the burden of working out deals with whoever's willing to participate, and he's digging into his savings to pay the rest.
Where things will end up, I don't know. I hope they're not where they are now or that it doesn't deteriorate, but we refinanced the house. We took out a large HELOC loan on the house as well.
So HELOC loan, that's a home equity line of credit, right?
Exactly. And Werner says all of that money that he's getting is going towards paying that lack for what he's not making up in the building. And those buildings are exactly what he's worried about. He says he takes a lot of pride in the properties and he wants to keep people in housing. But if he can't afford them, he worries he'll have to sell and he doesn't know what will happen to the tenants.
You know, Jerome, you've heard a whole lot about landlords pushing out tenants. Others worry about having to sell. Are there some who just feel like this financial burden of the pandemic is just landing all on them?
Absolutely. And that's why the Apartment Association of Greater Los Angeles is suing the city over the requirement that landlords stop evicting people. And the group essentially just wants to pressure the city to drop the moratorium altogether because they say that the move infringes on their Fifth Amendment right, which prevents the government from taking their property without compensation. So I spoke to Dan Uchelson, who's the executive director for the association, and he says the pause in evictions discourages tenants from working out a deal with landlords because they don't have to prove if they're affected. And with no end in sight, landlords are stuck with the bill at least for the next year based on LA's moratorium.
There's no termination on it right now, and there's no obligation of renters to provide any information to the owners whatsoever, not even inform them that they're not going to be paying their rent, and owners are not allowed to ask for any kind of information. So owners are really just left in the dark, and it's impossible to operate a business if you can't communicate with your customers.
And I have to point out that Uchelson's organization has already urged some cities in California to end their eviction moratorium. In April, the city of Upland repealed their eviction moratorium after receiving a letter from the Apartment Association's attorney. And Uchelson says that he's seeking financial compensation from the city to help his members recoup lost payments so they can be made whole.
There's so much hurt going around, I guess, with so many people. Anna, I'll bring you back in. Is there anything on the horizon that could provide more relief to both tenants and to landlords?
Well, there's one measure working its way through the state legislature that's trying to address both, Senate Bill 1410. Basically, the way it works is it gives tax breaks to landlords in exchange for forgiving rents and halting evictions. And then tenants would have 10 years to repay their debts back to the state. So it's passed through the Senate. It has to pass through the state assembly. Small landlords are fighting it. They're afraid that tenants might take advantage of it. But, you know, this isn't just a Los Angeles problem or even just a California problem. There are hundreds of millions of renters in this country. There are other cities that have lifted some of the eviction protections and seen eviction filings go up. And so there's this question mark of, you know, is the federal government going to do more in this arena? Leaders here in LA have said that they need more help in order to do more to provide relief to people. So we'll just keep following it and we'll see.
It's obviously a very important story that we're following, something that you guys will continue to follow as well. Not only renters being evicted, but if the landlords don't get the money from their properties, then they might be evicted or forced out of their homes. I mean, it's a problem all the way around. KCRW's Anna Scott and Jerome Campbell. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Pop quiz. Which California county has the most acreage of legal pot grows? If you answered Humboldt, you wouldn't be alone. After all, it's known for years as the home of California's weed, or for that matter, the nation's weed. But the right answer is actually a little closer to home. Try Santa Barbara County. Despite having only about 1.8% of the state's land, an LA Times investigation last year found that Santa Barbara had about 35% of all the state's cultivation licenses. By comparison, Humboldt had only about 22%. So how did a county best known for tourism and its wine region come to be the state's pot capital? Turns out that's the focus of a scathing grand jury report that came out last week. And in a blog post, longtime local journalist Jerry Roberts says the report documents, quote, a disgraceful political process teeming with influence peddling, secrecy, and sleaze. And Jerry Roberts joins me right now. Hey there, Jerry.
Hi, how are you, Steve?
I'm all right. Influence peddling, secrecy, and sleaze. Wow.
Not to put too fine a point on it. Yeah.
I mean, really?
Well, the grand jury report, you know, really capped about a three-year chapter of conflict and exposés. And I'm glad you mentioned the LA Times. Shout out to Joe Mazingo, who really set the roadmap for this. But basically what happened was that two members of the Board of Supervisors meeting as an ad hoc committee, which allowed them to evade the Brown Act, the Open Meeting Act, and set the pattern for this legislation, and they were influenced by both growers and lobbyists for the industry during that period. The grand jury report noted unfettered access to the industry, and it really resulted in trying to implant a new industry into Santa Barbara County, which, as you know, Steve, is small, as you point out. We got about 2% of the land. And, you know, it's hard to build a doghouse in Santa Barbara County without 12 years of permits and everything. But the way that they worked the process, it was really a top-down thing, and it's drawn a great deal of community ire and a challenge to one of the supervisors, a number of lawsuits, appeals, and so on and so forth. Here we had some prime examples of transactional politics with politicians and special interests, and I think people are extremely unhappy about that.
You say transactional politics. I mean, is that pay to play? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I think it, not to put too fine a point on it. You know, the grand jury report notes a number of instances in which supervisors received text emails on the day of, on the day before, key votes. And then if you look at campaign contributions, you can kind of match those up. In some cases, Supervisor Williams had something like $65,000 from industry sources, at least. We haven't seen his final report in the campaign that ended on March 3rd. He was reelected, we should note. And so, yeah, the grand jury refers to the unfettered access of the industry and its lobbyists to the supervisors and said that it was really out of scale. And I think scale is the key point here, because they really tried to implant a new industry rather than trying to see, you know, if we couldn't work it in a more compatible way with neighborhoods and other industries.
You mentioned, unfettered notwithstanding, there are a lot of these meetings you mentioned were quote-unquote ad hoc. So that's how they got around the law, the open meetings law, right? That there were too few people in these meetings where there had to be, you know, public access.
Correct. And, you know, there's no notes of those meetings. There's no minutes of those meetings, no record. So really it was going on, you know, behind the scenes out of the public eye. I don't think the grand jury certainly didn't say there was anything illegal that went on, but they did call for the establishment of a county ethics commission and pointed out that the supervisors don't even have a code of ethics by which they're operating under. So, you know, I think the process and the perception of how that went down, it was very pro-industry. Supervisor Williams is someone, you know, and he'll openly say he's been advocating for the legalization of marijuana since back when he was on the city council here in the early aughts. So it's not a surprise that he would do that, but that became the guiding principle. We're going to establish a quote-unquote robust cannabis industry here. A lot of people in the majority in Santa Barbara County voted for Proposition 64, which legalized marijuana in California. Nobody voted for the scale and the scope of the plan that they came up with. And so there's a lot of scrambling to address perhaps unintended consequences.
And the remedy here, or at least one of the remedies here, according to the grand jury report, is create an ethics commission, you know, create rules, robust, speaking of robust, robust rules around lobbying, right?
Correct.
How much teeth would that have in Santa Barbara County in the case of this?
Well, I think it's it would certainly be an after the fact case. I think it's really something looking going forward, because I think one of the problems with what's happened with cannabis is it's really it's lowered the public view of the integrity of the Board of Supervisors and of county government in general. And at a time when we're struggling to have confidence in any of our institutions, I think that's a recommendation by the jury that they're trying to help reestablish some of that.
Jerry Roberts has covered state and local Santa Barbara politics for a long time. And Jerry, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Steve.
All right, let's turn now to Doss Williams, who's a Santa Barbara County supervisor. Mr. Williams, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So you saw the grand jury report. What do you think?
Well, I think that it's natural that full implementation of legalization of marijuana is going to be a bumpy road. I would say that we have to do a process of agreeing or disagreeing with every single point in the report. But as a totality, I felt that it showed a remarkable lack of knowledge about what a county's actual land use authority and options were back in 2017. The county had already had legal marijuana. And since the ordinance has taken place, we've closed down a ton of the grows that couldn't live by the rules. And we've started the process of permitting grows that can live by the rules. And that has been tremendously important for knocking out the black market. It's been tremendously important for employment in our county and good wages. And it's been tremendously important in order to save basic services at the county in the middle of the COVID economy.
I want to talk about, you said, you know, obviously getting rid of the black market or making sure that those grows are licensed and doing things above board. But there's this accusation in the grand jury report about creating these ad hoc, so-called ad hoc committees in order to circumvent the state's open meeting laws to make sure that these grows have what the grand jury report says, unfettered access. I mean, that's a pretty damning accusation right there.
It is, except that you, when you work in local government, you're supposed to have everyone have unfettered access. You know, I found it annoying how often marijuana folks wanted to meet with me, but that's my job to meet with people. I also found it annoying.
Your job is also, though, to serve the public. Your job is to make sure that the public has access to those meetings as well. And that's the contention of the report, is that there was no public access to those meetings, the unfettered access, as it were.
The ad hoc meetings did not include anybody from the marijuana industry. The ad hoc meetings were meetings between county staff and two supervisors. The fact is, I live in Carpinteria. My constituents are impacted both by the good and the bad of marijuana. And we needed a process that would deal with nuisance in an expedited fashion. And that wouldn't have taken place without an ad hoc committee.
Wouldn't have taken place as in you wouldn't have been able to meet so quickly? You wouldn't have been able to been so...
Now, government is very slow. We started working on this in January of 2017, but still rules were not in effect in the coastal zone in Carpinteria in my area till November of 2018. So how am I supposed to tell the public, oh, you know what, we have this issue, this problem, but you know what, we're going to take 3 or 4 years to make rules.
Why do you think there's such a rush, though? And I mean, Santa Barbara County is such a small land area as compared to the rest of the state, but has, you know, a large percentage or a larger percentage than any other county of pot grows.
The reason for speed is twofold. One is we already had those grows, so they were already impacting the community, both in good ways and negative ways. In good ways from an employment perspective and from wages, but from a negative perspective, odor. And so if you read the ordinance, it has essentially a zero standard for odor, the most stringent standard you can have. And I want that applied to as many of places as possible, as quickly as possible. And so that's the really the vital part of speed. The second reason is enforcement. You know, the rules of medicinal marijuana always made enforcement and adherence to the rules very loosey-goosey. We do not want loosey-goosey. We want to permit the ones that can live by the rules as quickly as possible, and we want to shut down the ones that can't live by the rules as quickly as possible. And so since November of 2018, we've closed down, we raided 72 operations and closed down the majority of those.
You mentioned that those grows were already there, many of those grows, but there was an LA Times investigation that I'm sure you're aware of, that some folks were lying to you, that those were not medicinal marijuana grows. And just, you know, looking at Google Earth, you could tell that you know, those grows weren't there before. Well, how do you react to that? What's your response to that investigation?
If we had not had people sign those affidavits, we would not have been able to hold those people criminally accountable.
But the rules in other counties, supervisor, is that the state required proof ahead of time. This was just an affidavit that you would have these folks sign, sort of, you know, giving you their word that there was no grow there before, or that there was a grow there before. So how do you jibe that? Why is it different in Santa Barbara County than every other county in California?
It's not different. If you looked at the process, many other counties did the exact same thing.
But you see why this sort of, to some folks, smells a little odd, right? That there's so much acreage in Santa Barbara County as opposed to other counties in the state. There, you know, you get your campaign contributions come from, you know, pot lobbyists, you know, trying to grow weed. And look, I mean, it's legal, yeah, but it kind of smells bad. I mean, how do you address that, especially in light of this report?
Well, the people, most of the people that grow marijuana in my community of Carpinteria are the same flower growers, old Dutch flower growers, that are pillars of that community, fund Girls Inc., fund the Boys and Girls Club, they fund the school district. So I don't have a problem with, you know, having their support. Now, you know, I got the issue. So when I ran for re-election last year, I didn't take any campaign contributions from them. But I think that the process has been enormously good for the community and the county. We have tens of thousands of people right now that are out of work. We have hundreds of thousands of people who are slipping deeper into poverty. But we have 5,000 jobs that aren't going away that pay an average of $65,000 a year in farm work. Furthermore, we would have faced dramatic cuts to public safety, to child welfare positions, and to our basic social services if we had not had the tax revenue that came in from marijuana, which has been enormously significant. It's larger now than our sales tax. And if you are having a sheriff respond to an emergency on time, if your neighbor's abused child has somebody taking care of them, if you have a library that's open, it's because of marijuana tax revenue. in this community. And so I think it's been on balance good. We have some issues with odor to get fixed, but all of the things that the opposition are proposing, including the grand jury, would make it longer to fix the odor. I don't want to make it longer to fix the odor. I want to make it shorter.
Doss Williams, supervisor in Santa Barbara County. Thank you, sir, for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much.
And before we go, Superintendent Austin Buettner today said LA schools will once again be online only when the school year begins next month. That's as the number of coronavirus cases continues to climb. Governor Gavin Newsom today closed down a host of businesses, I should say re-closed, in Los Angeles and other counties, including gyms, hair salons and barbershops, personal care services, malls, even some houses of worship. With about a quarter of the state's population, LA County has more than half of the state's COVID deaths. So here we are again. Tomorrow on this program, who's choosing to gather at a time like this? You'd be surprised. It's a lot of folks. And we'll talk about Orange County schools with Gustavo Arellano. Jenna Cagle, Kaylee Wells, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Ray Guarna, Mario Diaz, Desmond Taylor, Amy Roken, Christine Comito, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on this show. I'm Steve Chiatakis, thanking you for your ears and your time. Have a great night.